Schaefer versus Bush. Ms. Horstman.
May it please the court, I'm Karen Horstman, court-appointed amicus on behalf of the interests of Dennis Christopher. Mr. Christopher wanted me to extend his apologies to you today because he's on parole in Kentucky and was not allowed to travel to Chicago for this argument. This is an appeal of a dismissal of a pro se complaint filed by Dennis Christopher under 42 U.S.C. section 1983. At the time he filed his complaint, Mr. Christopher was incarcerated. The amended complaint was dismissed by the district court under 28 U.S.C. section 1915A on the grounds that the complaint failed to state a claim upon which relief could be granted. Mr. Christopher is asking this
court... Are there any pictures of this, what's described as a protrusive lip?
No, Your Honor, there are not. The only
Has it been fixed, do you know?
That we don't know either, Your Honor.
Do we know how... What do you mean by... Well, could you describe what it is?
Your Honor, I know nothing more other than that it's described as a protrusive lip. I think some was referred into there as a 90-degree angle. This did not go beyond the complaint, basically.
We just have the complaint?
Yes. It was dismissed under basically a 12B6 on Section 1915A.
And does the complaint allege that someone else had been injured previously?
As a matter of fact, Your Honor, in his amended complaint filed on August 26, 2002, Mr. Christopher did allege that another inmate had been injured in the same manner, under the same circumstances, in the same location, in the same softball field, and suffered the exact same type of injury to the right eye. Mr. Christopher alleged in his complaint that the defendant's knowledge of this shows that they knew of a substantial risk of serious harm to the prisoners and that their failure to correct the situation so that it happened again when he was injured is a violation of the Eighth Amendment under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983.
Was he forced to participate in that?
No, Your Honor, he was not forced to participate in that. But at the same time, when he did participate, he alleges in his complaint they did not tell him about this prior injury or about this danger that was out there in the softball field. The question of whether Mr. Christopher's amended complaint sufficiently pleads a violation under the Eighth Amendment was addressed by the district court. However, that district court opinion contains two errors. The first error is when the district court states that Mr. Christopher's amended complaint did not contain, quote, a suggestion that the defendants left this part of the field unattended so that balls would bounce off of it and injure inmates.
Does anything really turn on this? I appreciate the argument that intent may be pleaded generally and all that, but the Supreme Court also says that district courts can dismiss delusional complaints. And it seems to me that a claim, gee, the guards really wanted to get me, so what they did was poorly groom the infield in the hope that a ball would jump up and hit me in the throat. That strikes me as positively delusional belief.
Your Honor, that's not what was alleged in the complaint. What he alleged in the complaint, that someone was injured and that they failed to take action to correct this so that they knew of the risk. He does not.
You think that's what's alleged in the complaint, though? That's negligence.
No, Your Honor.
To have a claim, it has to be a claim of intent to injure the prisoners.
Actually, Your Honor, in Farmer versus Brennan, the U.S. Supreme Court has specifically held that it is unnecessary to show that a prison official failed to act while believing that harm would actually befall a prisoner. Instead, in Farmer, the Supreme Court held that it must be shown the prison official knew of the substantial risk of harm and failed to act despite that knowledge. Your Honor, there are many things that occur in prisons that there has been where the prison official did...
What the Supreme Court said is that deliberate indifference means the same thing as criminal recklessness. Suppose I offered to show that two infielders had been hurt by bouncing balls at Wrigley Field over the last 3 years. Do you think the groundskeepers could be convicted of criminal recklessness?
Your Honor, if those ball players were under your control, under those groundskeepers' control, and those ball players had no other way to be able to get out and play ball, that they were sent out onto that field by those groundskeepers, then it becomes a different situation. Yes, in this case...
No, I think your point would be different. If there's some sort of hidden trap, that would be what...
Well, exactly. Your Honor, if this were a case...
Well, your argument, there's a trap here. They knew it because of this prior injury. They didn't do anything about it.
Yes, Your Honor, exactly. I mean, it would be like, let's say that the prison bus, the brakes were not operating properly on the prison bus. Prison officials knew it. They knew that if the brakes failed, it would cause a serious accident, posing a substantial risk of serious harm to these prisoners. But despite that, for whatever reason, whether they wanted to hurt these prisoners, whether they didn't have the money in their budget to fix this bus, or because they had a trial court judge that was demanding those prisoners be brought there now, whatever the reason, the prison official sends them out on that bus, the bus crashes into the mountain as an accident, and the prisoners are injured. To say that a prison official could act in that way, simply because, and get away with it, is contrary to what the Eighth Amendment is all about. It's because these prisoners are put into these conditions where they're under the control of this that we don't just
but
say...
But he wasn't put in that condition. He voluntarily went out on that field, didn't he?
He voluntarily went out, Your Honor, but was not told about the field.
How much should a softball player know about the field if the lip is up like that?
If going back to my example on the bus, if it were a volunteer effort to go out and do community work by the prisoners and the prisoner climbs on that bus and the bus's brakes fail, then that's a volunteer effort.
You can't see the brakes. You can see the infield.
But this is not an obvious risk. And that, again, is part of the, is noted in Farmers. The obviousness is part of the circumstantial evidence to show.
Have you ever played baseball?
A long, long time ago, Your Honor.
It's perfectly obvious how much gap there is between the dirt and the grass where the infield lip makes the transition to the outfield. Anybody can look at it. In fact, it's a well-known danger to infielders that the ball will jump when it hits that transition zone. You can see whether it's big or small, where the transition zone is. In fact, you're a pretty reckless infielder if you don't carefully look at the field. You also want to look for stones and a few other things.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know the experience of Mr. Christopher when it comes to playing baseball or whether the prison officials would be sitting him out there. It's between first and second, I believe, Your Honor. Beg pardon?
That's not a position.
He was the first and a half baseman, is that
He's
the other
something like that, yes. But
this was hardball or softball?
This was softball.
Softball?
Yes. And going back, though, about what you were saying about...
Is this real softball or Chicago softball?
This was in Indiana, so goodness knows what kind of softball it was.
It's likely a real softball, which is hard, rather than a Chicago
He did have 9 stitches to his eye, and the prior prisoner had 4 stitches to his eye, and that was pled in the complaint as well. The district court seemed to hang its hat upon the fact that the defendants could not control the path of the ball. And the district court's reasoning, if taken to its logical conclusion, it fails. For example, if a prison official gives a gun to an inmate, the inmate shoots the gun up in the air, ricochets off the side of the building, comes down, strikes another prisoner, then under the district court's reasoning, because the prison officials could not control the trajectory or the course of that bullet, then they're not responsible. The equivalent here is that they knew that this danger was out in the field, and they knew by giving these players a bat and ball that they were putting them into this risk and didn't tell them. Thank you, Your Honor.
Okay. Thank you very much, Ms. Horst. Mr. Steiner?
Thank you. Hey, please, the court.
We're talking about a situation here where the district court has to screen a complaint. In this case, it was a complaint, an amended complaint under 1915A. It's a duty of the court, and it's a duty that Congress has mandated on the district courts, and really for review on occasions in this court, because it makes sense to weed out those cases which are not federal claims at an early stage. When you do that, you avoid spending time.
I understand you. It seems to be a perfectly straightforward complaint. May be, completely unsubstantiable, but he says there's this hazard, and they knew about it. They didn't warn him. It's serious, serious injury to a previous inmate, and equally more serious injury to him. What more do you need?
Well, I think the problem in this case is that he's alleging negligence.
Well, he's also alleging reckless indifference, because the difference is we have a known risk because this has happened before and they don't do anything about it, and of course they could have corrected it easily, presumably. That's recklessness.
Well, in Farmer, the Supreme Court said there were really two components, two adjectives that are very important in analyzing these kind of cases. Said that the risk had to be substantial and that there had to be a risk of a serious injury. And what we have in this case, and this is
well,
what
we certainly have the latter, right? We have the serious injury.
Well, we had a serious injury, but it has to be a situation where the defendant... It would have to be a situation where the prison official would anticipate that a serious injury would...
Well, if it happens once, it's likely to happen again, isn't it?
It's possible it would happen again, but it's... Any time someone steps on a softball field, there is a potential for some risk.
No, we're not talking about a field that's well maintained. We're talking about the field with its protrusive lip, whatever that is. I don't know what a protrusive lip is.
I'm not certain exactly what that protrusive lip is, but I assume from various descriptions...
Well, why assume? I mean, you're allowed to do notice pleading, and he could have pleaded less, probably, but he pleads that... there was this hazard, it had caused a serious injury, nothing was done about that, and he wasn't warned, so he was, trapped.
Again, Your Honor.
Well, it's not a good claim.
I think the district court got it right. That's why I was talking about...
Well, what's wrong with it?
Well, wrong with it is the fact that I don't think there's any showing that there's a substantial risk of injury to Mr. Christopher in this case when we have an allegation of one single incident of a bad bounce of a ball where we have someone running to make a play where the ball is rolling across the field, which is a recreational field.
Rolling?
Which is rolling or bouncing.
Well, wait a second. How could a rolling ball hit a person in the eye unless he's lying on the ground?
He did not say he was lying on the ground, Your Honor. In this case, what Mr. Christopher said was that he was playing apparently second base. He was playing between first and second. One would assume he was playing second base. He came up to make a play on a ball that was coming toward him on the field. The ball hit what he called a protrusive lip, which was apparently the place where the infield joins the outfield grass. It bounced in a way that he didn't anticipate, in an unexpected way. And rather than catching the ball or hitting it with his glove, the ball hit him in the eye. And that's what we have. And that's what he alleges occurred on one single incident prior to this time, that something similar had happened, that a player had been trying to make a play on a ball, that the ball had happened to hit this spot
on the
field.
The question is really how much you have to put in your complaint. Now, it would have been better if he'd explained, how long the lip had been there and how recent the incident with the other player was and how big the lip was and whether you could see it and avoid it and all that stuff. But that's not required in a pleading, is it?
Notice pleading is required. However, I think the district judge in this court has every right to look at what the individual does say in the complaint to make a reasonable judgment about whether
the
claim
is. He didn't plead his way. He didn't plead himself out of court by alleging that there had been a previous similar incident, did he? I mean, that bolsters his claim. What more do you want in
the complaint? It indicates that this kind of...
What would you like to see in the complaint?
Well, I don't think that he is in a position, given what he's alleged in this case, to likely make out a federal claim, and that's the reason why the district court determined and made the decision that he did in this case. He looked at this case and said that it is not likely at all. It is, in fact, using the notice pleading standard. There's no likelihood that he's going to ever be able to prove that the defendant rec leaders and other officials were deliberately indifferent to his personal safety by allowing him to play softball on a field which wasn't absolutely perfect. And that's essentially what he's alleged in this case.
Well, he says the defendants have knowledge of the hazardous condition on the softball field, as in his complaint. Nevertheless, reacted to the hazard with reckless indifference. Not only did they fail to repair the hazardous defect on the softball field after a previous eye injury occurred there, they further failed to inform plaintiff about the hazard so that he could avoid serious eye injury. Now, why isn't that a sufficient allegation of a of recklessness.
Of would have to be basically equivalent to criminal recklessness. And that's
well, you
that's
don't put
really
that in the complaint and say equivalent of
well, under Farmer.
Deliberate indifference means there's a known risk of a serious injury which could be easily prevented.
A known risk of a substantial risk, which is more than known. Known really can go to negligence, can go to that situation where
you know
about
it one
time.
You don't understand. You don't need knowledge for negligence. You don't have to know there's a risk.
No, you don't.
Which fails to take the care of a reasonable person. If you know that there's a risk, and you've made a decision not to deal with the risk, then if your decision is unreasonable because you could have prevented it and it was significant and could cause a serious injury, then you're reckless.
That's correct. Sometimes.
That's correct. Now, what more allegations should he have put in his complaint in order to state a claim for recklessness?
To state a claim for criminal recklessness. And this
look, would you forgive me criminal recklessness, please? You agreed with my definition of recklessness. So forget criminal. Now, what does he have to say in his complaint that he didn't say?
I think he has to, in this particular setting, we're talking about a recreational softball field. I'm not sure that an inmate in this setting where he volunteers to go onto a field.
That doesn't have anything to do with it. If he doesn't know about the hazard, I mean, suppose there's a hole in the field that's covered with, you know, leaves or something. He steps in it and breaks his leg.
Of course,
then that's no problem because he didn't have to play. He didn't have to commit the crime, right? Then he wouldn't be in prison.
That's correct.
So how far are you going to carry this argument about voluntary participation?
Well, I think it has a part to play because I think it comes into play when we think about most of the cases where we deal with the deliberate indifference standard. We have a situation where the prison officials are put on notice.
Yes, precisely. They were put on notice by the injury to the other inmate.
That there was a substantial risk of a serious injury. And often it will be in the kind of situation where they are aware of some offender in the prison, an inmate, who is dangerous to other offenders, and that person has said he's going to hurt
someone. But you don't have
someone.
To have an offender dangerous. You can have a physical condition that's dangerous to someone.
You could, possibly.
Impossible.
But I don't think...
We've had loads of cases like that.
There are cases where, like the bus case...
There's fire cases. People sealed into a bus and so on. Yeah.
That's a very dangerous... That could be a very dangerous situation.
Right.
In any event, Your Honor, I think that we have to look at the fact that the district court did examine this case, I think, in a very realistic, practical way, determined that essentially Mr. Christopher was talking about negligence. He wasn't talking about deliberate indifference under the standard of Farmer because he wasn't talking about, with one previous incident of a bad bounce of a baseball, a situation where those officials were on notice that this was likely to happen again in just this way, that there was a substantial risk to Mr. Christopher in that way, or that they would likely expect a serious injury. Balls bounce in funny ways off of fields all the time, and people are not seriously injured. He needed to show both. He did not. I would ask the court to affirm the district court.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Steiner. Mr. Steiner, Ms. Horstman?
Your Honor, as a former federal law clerk, I appreciate the district courts wanting to take control of their dockets. I know that problem quite well. But even so, under Section 1915A, a case can only be dismissed if it appears beyond a doubt that plaintiff can prove no set of facts in support of his claims which would entitle him to relief. Now, whether he is successful on this claim is another matter altogether. But this today is not about whether his position is meritorious. Today it is about whether he has sufficiently pled an allegation of a violation of the Eighth Amendment under 42 U.S.C. Section 1983. Whether there is, and as far as the probability of a substantial risk of harm versus a possibility of a substantial risk of harm, that has not been addressed by the U.S. Supreme Court. As long as that risk of harm is present and as long as it's known, it is an Eighth Amendment violation. Thank you.
Okay.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Ms. Horstmann. Thank you for acting as amicus curiae. Okay. Now,